So thank you very much again for listening to me. We're going to be talking now in terms of therapy of MDS, so the changing phase of MDS, advances in treatment. My name is Guillermo García Manero. I'm a professor of medicine at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, where I lead the MDS program, and I'm also the deputy chair for translational research here. So if you listen to my prior talk regarding prognosis, cytogenetics, molecular, you see that over the last 10 years, we have made quite a bit of progress in understanding this disease and also in terms of how to apply this type of molecular information into the actual care of our patients. Now, we're lagging a little bit in treatment discoveries, but I think actually this is going to change in the next couple of years. So in this next half an hour or so, I'm going to talk to you about what are the major paradigms of therapy of MDS today, and hopefully how this is going to change in the near future. So in this slide, this is from a paper that I wrote with Iha Patala, who is now in Wisconsin, a few years ago. And we came with a kind of like a short NCCN type of guideline that you have there. And what you see is that we divide patients into lower risk and higher risk. In the low risk, we still talk by IPSS, low, intermediate one. I guess by IPSSR, this will be low, intermediate one, and some group of patients with intermediate risk disease, or to make it easy, perhaps blast less than 10%. And then for that group of patients, there are a number of interventions that one could think of, like iron chelation, growth factors, although I don't know that nowadays actually we use them very much either as therapeutic intent. But for sure, the hypomethylating agents, lenalidomide, immune modulation, they are, you know, basically our standard of care. And then there's a question in terms of when to do or perform an allogeneic stem cell transplant in our patients. And then you go to the high-risk column, where this is actually a little bit more complicated, where you may divide patients not only by IPS risk or percentage of blasts, but also by age. And I put in this slide 60. The question is this now 65, but this is probably depending on the comorbidity and the overall performance of patients. But then the question there is, should you give hypomethylating agent or should you use induction chemotherapy? And then the other question that is not answered today is, when do you do a stem cell transplantation at the time of diagnosis, at the time of best response, at the time when you start losing the response? So I'm going to try to go through this talk. The next issue, and I think this is critical, is that, of course, you're going to be classifying your patient based on IPSS, IPSSR. But practically, I think the slide that I show here is very important. That is, you're going to be talking about MDS, thinking about them in four different buckets. Low risk versus high risk. That we already discussed. But then you're going to ask the question, has this patient received any prior therapy? In particular, has the patient have hypomethylating agent? Has the patient have lenalidomide? Why? Because prognosis of a patient with untreated low-risk disease is different than a patient that has received hypomethylating agent. Indeed, actually, we call this hypomethylating agent failure, and this could be high risk or low risk. And as you see in the slide, the importance is that a patient with high-risk disease with HMA failure has a survival of 4 to 6 months. A patient with low-risk failure has a survival of 14 to 17 months. And the biology of this disease in the frontline versus in the relapse setting is totally different. And the sensitivity and the chances that this patient will respond to second line therapy are also different. So you need to be aware of that when you approach your patient. So I always tell my fellows that when you approach a patient in the clinic, you think about this automatically. And then you say, well, these are the characteristics, cytogenetic, molecular, etc. But you need to have a frame, and I think this is actually a very important one. Of course, in the prior talk, I already talked about prodromes, like ICOS or something called CHIP, clonal hematopoiesis of unknown significance, that I kind of alluded earlier, where these are people that have mutations in their blood with or marrows that are normal or not totally normal, that are actually predisposing factors to maladysplastic syndrome. And the question now is whether we're going to consider them or not as a group of patients that we want to treat. I think most of us now, of course, we'll observe these patients, but in a more closer way than what we used to do a few years ago. And then, of course, in the right, at the end of the spectrum, you have the group of patients with AML, but this is a different group of patients because these are patients with MDS that will go on to evolve into acute myelogenous leukemia. So I'm going to go through therapies for each one of these buckets. Let's start with low risk disease. And again, my intention here is not to cover every therapy because this will take quite a bit of time, but just to give you some updates or discuss some of the paradigms. Again, I think growth factors and iron chelation may be good supportive tools. I don't particularly see them as primary therapies for most of our patients. I think drugs that are established in this group of patients are agents like, in this case, lenalidomide. This is from the 004 trial published by Dr. Feno a number of years ago that really established this drug together with the data from Alan List as the standard of care for patients with 5q minus MDS. This is an important randomized trial where they compare basically placebo versus lenalidomide at 5 versus lenalidomide at 10, and it showed clearly that lenalidomide at 10 milligrams is the standard and very effective group of patients, therapy particularly for patients with a chromosome 5 alteration and that have platelets over 50 or 100,000. In my opinion, the drug has very little role if you are trying to treat thrombocytopenia or neutropenia, and particularly is not very active in patients with severe thrombocytopenia. Attached a couple of years ago, there was data from a randomized trial of lenalidomide in the non-DEL5Q minus group of patients that also showed some activity, but not to the extent that we see here with lenalidomide at 10 milligrams in this group of patients with lower risk MDS and a 5Q minus alteration. Now, one question that is important is that because these drugs were actually approved on single-arm type of trials, that we don't really know long-term survival effect of this compound and biomarkers associated with outcomes. So this paper that was eventually presented by Dr. List and Dr. Sequeres is crucial because it, for instance, correlates outcomes with lenalidomide and achievement of a complete cytogenetic response. So this is very important because at least you have a landmark in terms of similar to what you do in CML, that if your patient with 5q minus disease does not achieve a complete cytogenetic response, perhaps you may need to look for other alternatives and for sure continue therapy in those patients that achieve this type of complete cytogenetic response, similar to what we do in CML and acute myelogenous leukemia. Now, the drugs that, at least in our group, we use more frequently are the hypomethylating agents. And this actually may be different, for instance, from what they do in Europe, where the indication for hypomethylating agents seems to be more on a label for high-risk disease. But here in North America, we have a lot of expertise in using these compounds. This probably all started with the development of oral azacitidine. This is from JCO paper a number of years ago, where we did the first phase one trial of this compound that is now in a phase three trial. And we see actually that oral azacitidine has activity in patients with lower risk disease with responses actually that are close to 40 to 50%. So while we hope that at some point we will have a hypomethylating agent in an oral version, at Anderson we have been interested actually on developing lower dose schedules of either decitabine and or azacitidine. And an example actually is this paper that we presented at ASH last year, where we look at the results of a randomized trial comparing low-dose decitabine versus azacitidine. And in this part of the presentation, because of the design of the study, we were not able to show actually one versus the other, but we could give a composite view of outcomes. And I think actually this data is quite remarkable in lower-risk MDS. So we see a complete remission rate close to 40%, overall response rate close to 60%, with significant improvement in transfusions in our patients. And this is actually with attenuated doses of decitabine and azacitidine. Importantly, this is associated with a complete cytogenetic response rate over 20%. I don't know if people are aware that these hypomethylating agents actually have this capacity in our patients. And this actually translates in group of patients with what we call low-risk, high-risk features that I alluded to in my prior presentation to very acceptable median survivals that are in excess of what we will predict from the MD Anderson data. And you see that in the blue curve in this slide. So we are now very much considering this as the standard approach for our patients. And what we're talking about, for instance, are doses of decitabine of 20 milligrams per meter squared daily times 3 days, azacitidine 50 to 75 for 3 days instead of, you know, 5 or 7 day type of a schedule. And we have very good results with this type of approach. And this actually has led to a clinical trial that is open in North America through the MDS consortium, where we're basically having a strategy of early intervention for our patients, randomized patients between transfusion dependency, transfusion independency, and we randomized them into low-dose ASA, low-dose decitabine, standard azacitidine, or observation for those patients that are transfusion independent. The study is ongoing. We have right now close to 100 patients on this trial. This study actually may be a very important one in the next few years to guide us in terms of when and in who and what type of therapy we should use in this group of patients. And I think it's going to lead the way to basically the development of new oral hypomethylating agents that are basically now in phase one, phase two studies in this disease. Now, low-risk MDS failure is complicated, and I cannot offer you a lot of drugs outside the context of a clinical trial. But at least I can tell you, first of all, what the natural history is. So here you see the survival of patients with low-risk MDS after HMA failure, and it's a survival of around 14 to 17 months. Again, your patient is not going to succumb tomorrow, but they are not going to do well for a long period of time. And these today are patients that probably are candidates for investigational clinical trials. But importantly, this is a subset of patients that may be actually a good group to consider for allogeneic stem cell transplant. So this is data that we presented at ASH and published subsequently. And as you see there, actually, the group or the therapy that does the best are those that go for a stem cell transplant. So in my opinion, actually, this is a subset of patients, low risk, HMA failure, that do particularly well with stem cell transplantation. What about high-risk disease? Of course, still the standard is the hypomethylating agent. The question is it better in some patients to give a induction chemotherapy with an acute leukemia type program? This is a presentation a couple of years ago also at ASH, where we compare induction versus hypomethylating agent. There's actually no major difference in terms of outcomes. And if anything, there is a trend towards better survival with the hypomethylating agent, of course, with less toxicity. So I think that by and large, most of our patients are treated with a lesser intense type of approach. Now, are there differences? Is there any way where I will treat a patient with chemotherapy with MDS or a younger patient with MDS to whom I will not give to whom I will not give induction chemotherapy? And the answer is yes. So for instance, if a patient has a very complex karyotype, regardless of the age, and let's say a P53 mutation, I will probably not give chemotherapy unless the patient is very proliferative and I need to control the disease very fast. In contrast, actually, I may consider induction chemotherapy for a specific group of patients with diploid cytogenetics and some features at the genomic level that may predict for higher response rate with chemotherapy. And lately, for instance, I've come across some patients with like 10-15% blast with an NPM1 mutation that perhaps could do better with chemotherapy, although this has not really been tested in any prospective type of way. The standard, therefore, today is still hypomethylating agent. This is the data from 2010. This still is the best standard that we have. This is from the randomized trial of azacitidine in high-risk MDS, the very important paper by Pierre Fenot, where clearly it showed that azacitidine improved survival of these patients in a very significant fashion, and this has not really changed. And this is, again, the standard of care for most of our patients in the frontline care. We've been interested in looking at characteristics associated with outcomes. This from a paper published recently, where, for instance, we showed that having a P53 mutation does not affect outcome, at least in terms of response with the hypomethylating agent. Other investigators, for instance, have claimed that having a mutation on TET2 may be associated with better response to these hypomethylating agents, but the reality is that we don't really have a good biomarker for response to hypomethylating agent that still makes us basically treat everybody and adapt therapy depending on toxicity and response. Decitabine is another drug that is approved in the United States for MDS, developed here by Dr. Jacob Kantarjan at MD Anderson. We work quite a bit in terms of different doses and schedules. The standard for us will be decitabine at a dose of 20 milligrams per meter squared daily to 5 days. Again, this drug has taken perhaps a little bit of a second place compared to azacitidine because it was never shown to improve survival in randomized clinical trials, although there are probably multiple explanations of why that happened. And it's a drug that we commonly use in our group. Now, what is interesting about these hypomethylating agents is that some people, at least when I talk, have a view of these are more like palliative type of approaches. But actually, these drugs, if used with some expertise are quite powerful. Here I show you data where we again showed a complete saturnitic response rate of close to 20%. The French group, Attache, a couple of years had the same data. So you have a group of patients that may benefit from this type of strategies. And again, you have a tail there of group of patients, maybe 10 to 15% of them, that may be long-term survivals with the hypomethylating agent if you are able to use these drugs chronically. That is very important. Basically, this concept of do not stop these compounds because then the disease will become HMA failure and you will have a hard time basically treating those patients. We have worked quite a bit with doublets, for instance, ASA, lenalidomide, ASA, HDAC inhibitors. I am not sure what's going to happen with HDAC inhibitors. This is a presentation that I had at ASH this past year with a third generation HDAC inhibitor called placinostat. Very active combination in acute myelogenous leukemia, but in this randomized trial in myelodysplastic syndrome, basically we were not able to show a survival difference in this group of patients. And actually, very good outcomes again with single agent azacitidine in the community, suggesting that we are overall now getting very experienced and actually very good at using this type of hypomethylating agents in our practices. There's another doublet combining, for instance, oral rigosertib with azacitidine. This was presented again at us this year. The data shows a very high response rate, although oral rigosertib is a drug that is still in development and we're going to need quite a bit of a little bit more information in terms of how one will design a phase two or phase three trial with this group of patients. So because we have now such a great expertise in using hypomethylating agents, and we're really learning in terms of the chronic use and not to stop therapies, the reality is that this group of patients with high-risk MDS is becoming one of our major subset of patients, in at least in referral centers. And this is very important because the prognosis of patients with a higher risk MDS after HMA failure is poor. This is shown from this work by Lee Jabbour a number of years ago, where we clearly show that the survival is around 4 to 6 months. And again, these are patients that do not respond to another hypomethylating agent. They don't do well with induction chemotherapy. So this is a particularly difficult group of patients with this disease and a very active area of research. So we conducted a phase three trial, was published in Lancet Oncology a couple of months ago, with intravenous rigosertib against best supportive care. And this was actually the first phase three trial for patients with HMA failure. We were not able to basically beat the expected threshold in terms of survival that we had planned on the original trial, but actually we saw that rigosertib with minimal toxicity was associated with a trend towards better survival in a subset of patients with MDS, high risk failure. And you see that, for instance, survival of 8.6 months versus 4.5 months in this group of patients, particularly in what we call primary failure. So these are patients that do not or had not responded to the hypomethylating agent. So again, in the global picture with MDS, we were not able to show that benefit. But when we look at the specific subsets, those with primary failure disease actually benefited in terms of survival with rigosertib. And this has led to a second phase three trial of this compound. It's called INSPIRE. And here we are targeting basically this group of patients with primary failure that are the ones who benefited the most. This study actually is already open worldwide. There are around 10, 15 patients already on the study. And hopefully this could be one of the new leads in this disease. Now, once in a while, one is in a situation where you don't have genomic information or clinical trial, and the question is there's something that I could do off protocol. And we actually have quite significant expertise using very low doses of clofarabine with low dose RSC, particularly in patients with a diploid cytogenetics. So this is from a presentation at ASH this past year, where we see actually an overall response rate of around 40 to 50% and survival rates that are higher than expected in this group of patients. But again, this drug is not approved for myelodysplastic syndrome. You may use this as a compassionate use in this group of patients with hypomethylating agent, high risk failure if they are diploid. And then to conclude the talk, I would like to talk a couple of minutes in terms of the role of allogeneic stem cell transplant. This is a little bit controversial. I think this is also based on the expertise of each local center. I think that the data from these two slides I'm going to show you that were published by the IBMTR eventually in the JCO really clarify what is my current position in terms of transplant in this group of patients. So in lower risk disease by IPSS, meaning low intermediate one, if you look at this graph, the survival is inferior to the group of patients transplanted up front. Now, early on, I said that there's a group of patients with low-risk disease that do well with transplant if they are HMA failures. But based on this data, I do not see any reason to transplant anybody, regardless of age, early on in the course of the disease. The second is actually the role of transplant in high-risk patients. And here, the conclusion is that transplant improves survival of these patients, although I'm not sure it's curative. You basically have long-term outcomes in around a third of these patients, a little bit less. But if you look at this graph, you see that the hypomethylating agent crosses the transplant basically past 25 months. So you're looking at a group of patients with very stable disease that apparently can be cured with transplantation, but I don't think that they represent the bulk of patients with MDS. And one of the things that I will be interested will be in actually understanding who are these patients that are cured with this disease, because then we could basically omit this very aggressive type of approach for patients that may have early complications from the trial. And what is interesting actually is that the genomic data has helped us more actually in understand who are these patients that benefit or not from the transplant. And this is a very important paper by Dr. Behar in JCO, where they showed, for instance, that if you have a mutation on P53 and or DNMT3A, your patient is not going to do well with transplant. Now, I'm not saying that you should not transplant these patients. What we're saying actually is that the outcome is going to be worse, and therefore anticipate that and perhaps come with strategies for this group of patients. And one of the strategies, in a way probably similar to what the myeloma doctors do in their total therapy type of approaches, is the use of maintenance therapy with hypomethylating agents after transplant. This is an old paper now by Marcos de Lima when he was here at Anderson, where we gave low doses of azacitidine in the post-transplant setting with actually improved outcomes. And there's now a number of clinical trials that are following this lead, randomizes to therapy, no therapy in this context. And I think this is going to be actually a very important tool, and it's actually that is becoming now a standard of care for our patients, particularly if they have high-risk features after their transplantation. Now, to conclude, I want to tell you a little bit of what I said in these two talks. First is to emphasize that there is actually an increased role for genomic annotation MDS. Genes that are important are IDH1, IDH2, RAS, FLT3, for sure P53, ECH2, and the role of this information in transplantation that I just mentioned a minute ago. I think that, and I didn't discuss this in the talk, but there's quite a bit of data helping us understand better the role of hypomethylating agents at the cellular level, not just molecularly. There's a number of new compounds that are coming, drugs that block anti-CD33, 123, very exciting data with venetoclax or ABT-199, recently approved in chronic lymphocytic leukemia, new TGF-beta modulators like ACE536, ACE11, that are going to be very important in lower-risk disease. We discussed quite a bit the role of lower doses of hypomethylating agents in lower-risk MDS. These are standard in my group. There are a number of potent oral inhibitors like CC486. These are oral azacitidine, and Aztec-727. This is an oral form of the cytidine. I think these drugs are going to have an important role in MDS. There are second-generation hypomethylating agents coming like SGI-110. This is actually in a major phase 3 trial in AML, soon in MDS. And there's quite a bit of data actually linking checkpoint inhibitors with hypomethylating agents. So there are many clinical trials looking at combinations with PD-1 and PD-L1 inhibitors. We discussed the data with rigorcetib, and I want to bring to your attention that at least right now we have 3 ongoing phase 3 trials worldwide, like oral azacitidine, rigorcetib, and ACE536 for refractory MDS with ring sideroblast. So I think in the next 2 or 3 years, we're going to probably have many more phase 2, phase 3 trials that are going to lead to the approval of new drugs that, together with developments in AML at the level of genomic annotation and targeted therapy, are really going to transform how we take care of our patients. And of course, better use of stem cell transplantation and better stratification of our patients. And with that, I'd like to basically conclude and thank you for this opportunity. Thank you very much.